So, what's the Disney movie next year, Wreck-It Ralph?
Ralph Breaks the Internet, Wreck-It Ralph 2.
I don't know about that title.
Yeah.
It's a weird, unwieldy title.
I am 2019, not a fan
of Lost World Jurassic Park.
Okay, what the fuck, Spielberg? 2019 is Frozen 2, 2020 is Gigantic, and 2021 is Untitled Film.
Can't wait to see Untitled Film.
I know, it sounds exciting.
When am I going to get a goddamn title for the Han Solo movie?
It's going to be released in theaters, Untitled Han Solo movie.
It comes out a year from now. It doesn't even have a title.
I watched the Clone Wars episode on Mon Calamari
mm-hmm.
the other night. It really weirds me out that the female Mon Cala have breasts.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
isn't it strange?
Why do they have breasts? What do they need them for?
I don't know. There's whales lactate, right?
But whales are mammals. Are Mon Cala mammals? They can breathe underwater, it seems like.
What is a mammal in Star Wars? I don't know. Is a Gotala a mammal? Like,
does it have mammary glands?
I haven't seen a Gotala's chest or wherever they
it
might
does,
get their mammary glands.
It does seem like a very earthly...
It just seems like an easy way for you to be like, this is a woman.
Yeah,
and
right.
I want you to know it's a woman. Ergo, she has bosoms.
They should put big false eyelashes on.
That's true. Yeah, makeup like
or
big cartoon lips.
I was going to say huge lipstick.
Hey everybody, welcome to Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where a bunch of friends sit down, make a themed cocktail, watch a bad movie, talk about what they liked, what they didn't like, and then at the end, how they would fix that movie. I myself am Brendan Landbeast Drischler.
And I'm Chris Lava Whale Ravel.
And Lee is not with us tonight, so instead we have a special guest back once again for like the fifth time. Who dat?
This is Brendan Squidbat Neistat.
Brendan, thank you for coming back.
Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me, as always. It's a delight.
So with the three of us just again, this is
you
our...
know, three dudes.
Yeah,
fun. We're having guys' night again.
It's our sequel
just
to La La
Land.
And
none of us are wearing pants.
That's usual.
Long pants.
And for our follow-up to La La Land, we are doing Atlantis, The Lost Empire, the Disney movie from 2001. There's a lot to talk about.
There is.
There is. But first, before we get into all of that, I will cover the drink that we made. The drink that we made is called the Heart of Atlantis. It is 2 ounces gin, 1 ounce Concord grape puree, or in our case, Concord Divine Grape, which is a black grape that is bred to taste more like a Concord grape, 0.75 ounce Thai basil syrup, 0.5 ounce lime juice, and then topped off with some club soda. Chris, you and I were the only ones who had the drink as it is. Brendan had it without gin. What did
mm-hmm.
you think of it?
I thought it was really delicious. When you were saying that it was a grape that was made to taste more like a Concord grape, I thought it was going to be very sweet. But it wasn't. It was actually really nice and had a nice herbal quality to it. It was lovely. It was very refreshing. It had a really nice kind of like soft pinkish color as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The color was great.
Yeah. I really liked it. It was a lot earthier than I thought it would
mm-hmm.
be. I was very wary of Thai basil because it's kind of an anisey flavored
mm-hmm.
basil. And it cut the drink pretty nicely, actually. It was not very overwhelming, but it gave it a nice sort of herbal taste, which I did not expect it to have. And it was very cool and refreshing, I think. All the ingredients mixed quite nicely, which is not always something you can say here.
Yeah.
So I'm glad it worked out that way.
Yeah, it was delicious. It was a great call.
It tasted great, and I really liked the touch of the blue ice cubes.
Yeah,
yes.
We had blue heart ice cubes to represent our own Atlantic crystals.
There should be some salute given to host Brendan for this, because he found the concept, ran with it, created it, got all the ingredients. My one contribution was a martini glass full of Scandinavian swimmers, little under-the-sea life gummies.
That really sounds like a slang term for sperm.
I know!
Right. Yeah.
But like Northern European sperm.
Yeah, no, it's Baltic sperm. Now that we've covered the drink itself, Chris, would you be so good as to turn to our good friend Wikipedia and give us the synopsis for Atlantis, The Lost Empire?
I would love to, and strap in everyone, because much like this movie, we're going to have to like charge through a lot of mythology very quickly. Many centuries ago, a large tidal wave triggered by a distant explosion threatens to drown the island of Atlantis. In the midst of an evacuation from the capital city, the Queen of Atlantis is caught by a strange hypnotic blue light and lifted up into the heart of Atlantis, a powerful crystal protecting the city. The crystal consumes her and creates a dome barrier that protects the city's innermost district. She leaves behind her young daughter, Princess Kikita, as the island sinks beneath the ocean. In 1914, Milo Thatch, a cartographer and linguist at the Smithsonian Institute, who was marginalized for his research on Atlantis, believes that he has found the Shepherd's Journal, an ancient manuscript that contains directions to the Lost Island. After the museum board declines his proposal to search for the journal, a mysterious woman, Helga Sinclair, introduces Milo to Preston B. Whitmore, an eccentric millionaire. Whitmore has already funded a successful effort to retrieve the journal as a repayment of a debt to Milo's grandfather, recruiting Milo to lead an expedition to Atlantis as soon as he receives it. The expedition departs with a team of specialists led by Commander Lyle Rourke, who also led the journal recovery expedition. The crew includes Vinnie Santorini, demolitions expert, Mole Moliere, a geologist, Dr. Joshua Sweet, a medical officer, Audrey Ramirez, a mechanic, and Miss Wilhelmina Packard, a radio operator, as well as Cookie Farnsworth, a mess cook. They set out in the Ulysses, a massive submarine. During the journey, they are attacked by the monstrous Leviathan, a robotic lobster-like creature that guards Atlantis' entrance. The Ulysses is subsequently destroyed, but Milo, Rourke, and part of the crew escape by making their way to an underground cavern, described in the journal as the entrance to Atlantis. After traveling through a network of caves and a dormant volcano, the team reaches the borders of Atlantis. They are greeted by Kida, who resembles a young woman and discovers that the Atlantean language is the basis of many existing languages. Kida enlists Milo's aid in deciphering the Atlantean written language long forgotten by the natives. By swimming deep within the city's submerged ruins and translating underwater murals, Milo helps Kida uncover the nature of the heart of Atlantis. It supplies Atlanteans with power and longevity through the crystals worn around their necks. He is surprised that this is not mentioned in the journal, but recalls that a page is missing. Returning to the surface with Kida, Milo discovers Rourke has the missing page. Rourke and the crew betray Milo, intending to bring the crystal to the surface and sell it. Rourke mortally wounds the King of Atlantis while trying to extract information about the crystal's location, but finds its location for himself hidden beneath the King's throne room. The crystal detects a threat before merging with Kida. Rourke and the mercenaries lock Kida in a crate and prepare to leave the city. Knowing that when the crystal is gone, the Atlanteans will die, Milo berates his friends for betraying their consciences and ultimately convinces them to leave Rourke and remain in Atlantis. The king explains to Milo that the crystal has developed a consciousness. It thrives on the collective emotions of the Atlanteans and provides power, protection, and longevity in return. It will find a royal host when Atlantis is in danger. He then reveals that the sinking of Atlantis was caused when he attempted to use it as a weapon of war. As he dies, he gives the crystal to Milo, telling him to save Atlantis and Kida. Encouraged by Sweet, Milo rallies the crew and the Atlanteans to stop Rourke. In the ensuing battle inside the volcano, Helga and the other mercenaries, including Rourke, are all killed. Milo and the others successfully fly the crystal back into the city as the volcano erupts. With lava flowing toward the city, Kida, in her crystal form, rises into the air and creates a protective shield. The lava breaks away harmlessly, showing a restored Atlantis, and the crystal returns Kida to Milo. The surviving crew members return to the surface and promise to keep the discovery of Atlantis a secret. Having fallen in love with Kida, Milo stays behind to help her rebuild the lost empire. That was a gigantic mouthful, and now I understand what Brenda goes through every time he has to do this.
I'm glad you understand me a little bit better now.
I do.
So let's cover a couple of discussion topics right here. I think the first one that we can kind of kick off with, and that you might have got some idea from listening to the synopsis, is the world building of this movie and Atlantis in general. So there are, I think it's safe to say, a lot of things to like about this movie, and there are a lot of things to be utterly confused by. And I think where everything really falls apart is with Atlantis itself,
mm-hmm.
with the history, with the crystal, with its people. It doesn't really add up, and it just creates a lot of confusion, I think.
Where I want to start is where we're introduced to the Atlanteans, not as viewers necessarily, because we see them in that beginning,
mm-hmm.
the sort of cold open, if you will.
Yeah.
But when Milo and the gang first encounter them, they're people behind these very large, kind of kitschy-looking tribal masks with a lot of, like, fur tufting on them.
Yeah, it looks like a ripoff of Princess Mononoke.
But bigger and broader.
The mask is, like, the entire body, like, their entire torso.
Right.
Yeah.
It feels like a tiki, like a cartoon of, like,
mm-hmm.
a tiki or something
yeah.
like that.
Which is very Disney, let's just be honest.
But
yes.
You never see it again.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that the look of Atlantis was drawn from a lot of different cultural references, which I thought was pretty cool. But that was one thing that just, it really felt like they just put that in there as, like, an initial mislead. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's weird
yeah.
that that you get to see those warriors pretty early on, and then the rest of the Atlanteans that you see are all kind of confused and like, what do? I don't even know. Like, they don't know how to work any of their technology, and it's like, just even just from a primitive aspect, they should have been more prepared and more had their guard up more. And I don't think that you see that at all, really.
Also, outside of that scene, I don't think they have warriors.
Yeah,
really. I don't see weapons
very
often.
You just see random people on the street.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're supposed to be scouts, or they're supposed to be hunters, or what it is exactly that they are, because they don't seem to have an army. I mean, I guess the logical conclusion is, why would they have an army? Like,
right.
What's the point, really? Because they've been underground for thousands of years and nothing has ever happened.
I think they said it was, what, like 4,000 and change is how long they've been
under? He said that Kido was like 8,000 years old.
Oh.
At one point. He says,
but
like,
I thought Milo said something like, oh, you mean you're the one who was, like, you were here 4,000 years ago when the city went down?
He said something like, that would make you like 8,800.
Oh, yeah. I see. But then why even... it just seems like such a weird thing to do as like a mislead of like, they're not savages, they're actually pretty civilized. I was like, so then why did they have the giant, like, cartoonish tribal masks?
I mean, I guess it's just a fake-out for the audience, right?
Yeah,
you're supposed to think that maybe they're just creatures, like, random-ass creatures.
It's a dumb one, because you can see that twist, I get, or reveal, coming from miles away. You know that they're not going to be creatures behind the mask.
Well, right, they show you what Atlantis looks like in the first scene of
right.
the movie. There's no mystery, really. Which is one of, I think that, you know, we'll talk about this in a few other ways, but I feel like, seeing Atlantis in the beginning of the movie and seeing it later, you don't really get a sense of maybe how their society has changed. You see that maybe things are a little bit more weathered. You know, parts of the city have obviously been like chipped away because of the cataclysm. But I think that there's a missed opportunity there to really show how deeply impacted everything as time has gone on.
That was the other bit of confusion too, because if they have been, you, guess Brendan, you brought this up earlier of, how did they... Kira says at one point that we've, like, forgotten our culture. And you'd think, by the way, that that would be the goal that she or the Atlanteans have in mind. They don't really reclaim that culture, but the movie seems to believe
they
have.
Well, they've forgotten, like, their printed word. Like, they can't read
their
language.
They can't read, yeah.
And I think that's what they are trying to get at more so than...
I guess, but...
Also, their flying cars don't work anymore.
Because
they
can't read
the keys.
They can't read how to use the keys.
But it was... I just thought that it was just so weak. Like, it was just sort of, like, creating a really weak conflict. But that aside, you pointed out, guest Brendan, that why, if all these people who are living there were there then, how is this forgotten? It would make a lot more sense if it was more kind of like, oh, that was lost a few generations ago. They just never taught people how to do this.
Yeah,
that's
right. And I just don't understand the impetus for making that decision from a storytelling level, because I think it would be more striking if you had this tribe of kind of lost, bleary-eyed people who are living in the husk of what used to be Atlantis. You know, it'd be one thing having them rediscover it, but these people knew what the place looked like in its heyday, so why are they walking around like so confused all of a sudden?
So I did some research on this movie. And I watched a documentary on the Blu-ray about it. And one of the things they talk about...
You're doing God's work.
I am. The impetus of this idea came from when Napoleon went to Egypt. And he met, you know, Egyptian people there who were living amongst this culture and these ruins and these pyramids, but had no idea what they were built for or why they were there. So I think that, from like a story point of view, is a very intriguing germ of a story. When plopped in here, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because it's overly complicated by the fact that the Atlanteans have very long lifespans granted by the crystal. So if you were alive for thousands of years, it is less likely to me that you would have forgotten these things. Like, the Egyptians were not, like, hundreds of years
old
when Napoleon met them. They had good reason to not remember these things.
I don't even think it's they have long lifespans. Aren't they functionally immortal? Because of the crystal?
I think it's just a very long life, they say. Because, I mean, he still gets punched to death. The king gets punched to death.
That's true. We don't see him again.
I think they're just very long-lived, for my sake. I don't think they're immortal. Because Kira clearly ages, right?
I don't mean invulnerable. I just mean, like... Well, because that's why I made the comment during the movie when we were watching. Like, we see kids. Have they always been kids since the fall of the city?
Kira ages. It takes her a long time. But when you first see her, she's a child. And then you see her, she's an adult. So it takes her, you know, thousands of years for her to get from A to B.
Okay.
But they do age.
That's one hell of a puberty.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, like, what a horrible several hundred years it must be for you to deal with acne.
Fuck, then those kids, then, the children you see, they were infants.
What? I wonder what their development is like. When you're a baby for hundreds of years, like, do you become very self-aware as a baby?
We are officially creeps, by the way.
No, I don't think we are at all. I think this is something that you should think about, because it's clear that I don't think they did. Like, do you have to potty train a baby for hundreds of years?
Yes.
Like, this is where everything falls apart. It's because, like, they thought of this thing of, like, Napoleon, Egypt, and they're like, wow, that's really cool, let's use that here, and then didn't bother to, like, commit 100% to
it.
Well, and I think it's also a problem of they just didn't balance out all the different influences they were drawing upon. I think visually they more or less got there. There were some points where I was like, meh, but I love the way Atlantis looks. It almost, this is going to sound weird for an animated movie, but it doesn't look fake. It looks like it's an animated version of a city that could exist. Because it's like a, sort of a jumble of buildings and things are kind of at different levels. It's not very perfect and pristine looking, which I understand, of course, but it was still just a detail that I didn't realize I had missed in other things. I'm like, wow. And I also love, once they get going, all of the different, like, sea life-themed vehicles of Atlantis.
I mean, there's clearly a lot of research that's been done into making Atlantis look the way it does on behalf of the filmmakers. Like, they were drawing from a lot of different inspirations.
Right.
They weren't looking at Greco-Roman architecture like you might assume Atlantis would be. They were looking at, like, Mayan and Aztec and, like, Southeast Asia, and they were drawing from all these other different cultures. So, consequently, Atlantis looks different than what you might expect Atlantis to look like. And it's a good decision to have made it look that way. The look of the movie in general, we should also sort of point out real quick, graphic novel artist Mike Mignola did a lot of character design for the movie, so it has a lot of the looks of him. You might be familiar with his work, like, with Hellboy.
A lot of squared off fingers.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, angles. Like, even when there's sort of, like, curves, like, they're not straight curves, they're sort of more broken down. Like, you might think that, like, the real world should look very, like, mechanical and sort of square and angular, and for Atlantis to be sort of rounded because it's, like, a water influence, you might want it to look more flowing, which it's not really. There is a consistent visual style throughout the entire movie.
Well, it does break up at certain points, because it's almost like the movie at occasionally would have been like, hey, remember this is a Disney joint and not Mignola. So, like, I think the main character, Milo, is very Mignola in the way that he... And so is Whitmore. Because when he turns his head side to side, his beard just sort of snaps from one side to the other. But then you get to, like, Peeta's face is very just sort of, like, a Disney artist put it together in their sleeve.
I think there are times when Peeta looks very much in tune with the aesthetic, and there are times that she doesn't. I don't think she was animated terribly well as a character.
No. I think that the animation style, it kind of clashes with the character design. I think that there's a tension there that, for me, kind of breaks the illusion. Because I think that even though they clearly put a lot of time in whoever animated Milo, like, there's a lot of, like, expression in that character, and I can almost see the animator doing, you know, pacing back and forth, like, doing gestures and motions in the mirror. He's a character that really feels fully realized, but at the same time, I don't always know that hyper-animated style where he's moving a lot fits his character design, and I don't know, especially, I don't know if, like, Kida's shape is one thing, but I feel like they're always having to fudge what her shape is, so it weakens the character's, like, strong design by, like, having to stretch and morph just to get the right expression that you want, and it's kind of all over the map. And we were noticing also that the animation quality from shot to shot can vary, like, in kind of surprising ways, especially for pretty big budget animated.
Yeah,
I'm blanking on his name. What's the military guy?
Rourke.
He has a shot when they're trying to take down the balloon where he's kind of grimacing. His grimace is this weird crescent shaped thing that goes halfway up his head, and the way that he's moving it is very unnatural. He almost looks like Two-Face.
There's also weird, I don't know why it is, but toward the end of the movie, Rourke kind of flies off the handle in terms of how he's animated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially right before he dies in the sequence, he starts, like, just moving in very strange ways. Like, it feels like that sequence was maybe rushed or something like that, or maybe that was done early on when they didn't quite have a handle on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because for most of the movie, I think Rourke is very consistent in how he looks and how he moves.
Yeah.
But he gets, maybe it was an attempt to show that he's, like, slipping mentally or something like that, so he just starts going a little nuts, but it just...
That's a little generous.
Yeah, it pales in comparison to how he looks for most of the movie, because I think, really, there are a lot of shots of Rourke where it looks, like, super Mignola-esque, like, almost like the character probably. He, like, you basically has, like, a line for a mouth,
yes,
and, like, lines for eyes and, like, squared off features. Like, that is super fitting with his aesthetic.
Also, the kind of sidekick characters, the doctor and mechanic and Moyer and the
Audrey. Munitions.
Yeah, and Audrey. They all have very strong silhouettes. But I feel like you see less of them, or maybe, you know, some of them are a little more stoic and move less. But, you know, you also have Moyer, which... He's constantly moving.
Yeah.
And, like, he is allowed to be very gummy and expressive. And I just don't think that there's consistency from character to character. And in a movie that I think is trying to be taken seriously as an action picture, basically, as, like, a summer popcorn flick, there's too much going on with the animation. And it really, it kind of takes away from taking the characters as seriously as you would in, like, live-action, like, popcorn movie.
I think it was attempt to drive home that, especially with Molière, but I think to a more general extent with a lot of the sidekick characters were just supposed to be sort of, like, general comic relief.
They're really broad, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they're all very broad. I think they attempt to give shading to the Doctor and to Audrey.
Mm-hmm.
They get a little bit of character shading in there, but the rest of them are just, they are very cartoony, and I think that's reflected in how they're animated, too.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we're supposed to see them as people. They're really just these, like, wacky presences.
Archetypes.
Yeah.
I do think there's a correlation between, like, how goofy the characters are and how close to the traditional Disney style they are. Because
mm-hmm.
you have, like, Packard and Cookie and Mole, who tend to, like, move a lot more animated. Like, Packard doesn't really move at all, but just her the general way she looks. I feel like if you maybe plopped her in Hercules, you'd
okay.
be like,
yes.
okay, like, this
yes.
fits fine.
Yeah.
Or Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, she has a style that fits in with, like, the general Disney house style. And maybe some of it was honestly just that, like, they were not used to drawing that style.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it was a mm-hmm. challenge for them to have to think about how this, like, stoic, squared-off character would move, as opposed to, like, a lot more of the squash and stretch method of animation, which is, like, Disney's bread and butter.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, I think that the characters that move less fit the aesthetic better, or at least in certain scenes, if they move less, it tends to keep the shape truer to the original intent.
Which
yeah.
is funny, because it's kind of like, wow, then McNeila kind of did his job in that, like, well, I designed static characters.
Yeah,
and that's
it looks
great
as a comic.
Yeah, and I mean, that is a challenge, to be fair. Like, you can have something that looks tremendous on a piece of paper, but then when you have to move it, you're like, how would this character actually move?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, how would their face look if they turned it this direction? And, like, what's their hair going to do if they're looking the other
right.
direction? Like, and it can be very difficult to do, so I don't begrudge Disney for having to work with a challenge like that, but it's not a challenge that they entirely pull off throughout
yeah.
the movies. I want to go back real quick to the crystal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go, please.
What are the rules?
Yeah.
How
okay.
does this work?
Are there rules?
So, no one knows what the crystal is.
It's a lot of things, and it's also nothing.
Yeah, so
okay,
the crystal is
let's
like,
go down what Milo tells us in
right.
probably a great inadvertent editor note, right? Where it's like, I can't possibly tell you what this
yeah,
is about.
Milo admits in the movie that he can't explain what the crystal is, which, if you can't, my dude, how can I ever hope to understand what this crystal is?
The thing is, he's understood everything
yeah.
that he's read in that book up until this point,
right.
but he's useless.
And he just throws his hands up in the air and says, like, I don't know what to tell you, pretty
mm-hmm.
much. Which, like, as an audience member, I'm thinking the same thing. Like,
that's also what the movie is
yeah,
telling
what
us.
What are the
like,
rules of this crystal? So this crystal, it's a power source.
One.
It's their deity.
Two.
It's alive.
Three.
It's also a weapon.
Four.
It absorbs people of royal blood when there's a problem.
Five.
If it holds on to them for too long, they will be permanently part of the crystal.
Six.
It's also pieces of the crystal, I guess, are like part of like pendants that the
mm-hmm.
citizens of Atlantis wear, which
yes.
provide them, I guess. I don't know if it's the pendant that provides them with long life or being in proximity to the
I
crystal.
Think it's being in proximity.
It must be, because otherwise, like, you know, these people are going to go back up to Earth at the end of the movie, and like Whitmore's going to live to be like 3,000 years
so
old.
So they never really explore that, do they? Because
I assume it must be being in proximity to the crystal. But again, they don't explain also where these shards come from. Like, do they chop
off the source?
Yeah, do they go to the crystal and just like chip, 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 chip?
But the crystal, as far as we can tell, is never a solid thing.
Right.
It always looks like this ball
of
energy.
Yeah, it sort of just throbs and ebbs.
How is the crystal found? Why Atlantis?
So, okay, so this is what, I don't know if this came from just sort of like story meetings and was never in the movie, or if it came from the crappy direct-to-video sequel, which I've never seen, but apparently it was a comet or something that landed in Atlantis.
I would have loved this backstory.
See, so here's the thing, right?
That drives me crazy.
You run, with anything like this, you run the risk of explaining too much or explaining too little. Like, you don't want to have
mm-hmm.
someone sit down and be like, well, it was a comet, and then it absorbed our king, and so we were like, oh, this must be a god, let's worship it as a god, and then blah, 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 blah. Like, you don't want that, but also you don't want to be like, eh, it's a battery. It's our crystal. It's real. It's a deity. It's everything we want it to be.
I was going
to
say, it's pretty much just, it's whatever the plot needs, and at the moment, that's what it is.
Right, and the movie errs on the side of not explaining it, which is not good. Because I could not tell you what the rules are of this crystal.
It's not good, especially because it sets up the one person who could probably be able to tell us can't.
Yeah.
For, like, no reason.
Yeah.
So, if there was some way of, I would either then need him to know and tell us, or know less, so I don't have that expectation.
The thing that really bugged me watching this movie is, like, okay, so the Expeditionary Force, they're trying to profit off this expedition, and so they automatically think that this random, like, crystal thing is gonna be worth money to them
yeah.
in the real world. It's like, okay, it's this source of power equals money, but how would they, nobody knows how to use it or what it is, so why would it have any value?
See, that's... So, okay,
I don't know.
So all we know...
You might sell it to the Kaiser. I'm like, what's the Kaiser going to
well,
do with
all,
it?
So, okay. So what we know from the Shepherd's Journal that Milo has, that Rourke has stolen a page from, is that it's a power source of some kind, and that's what Rourke is getting from it. So I guess Rourke's conclusion is that if it's a power source, it can be used in some way. But I agree with you. It is a tremendous leap to be like, it's a power source, ergo it's a valuable weapon.
There's also no scene and no line of dialogue that establishes we're going to be rich.
Mm-hmm.
It just happens. At the turn, when Milo comes up from the water with Kida, and everyone's like, hey, we're going to take... It's such a shock, by the way, just because it's not really... It's not forecast in the movie. It's not foreshadowed in the movie that this is going to happen. You don't really get the idea from any of these people that they're out for money or treasure.
See,
really.
I don't mind that too much. I mind... It is a bit of an abrupt switch, I'll grant you that. The one thing I do like about Rourke as a character, and I said this when we were watching it, is that Rourke... They do a pretty good job with work with not full out playing the villain card
mm-hmm.
with him right away. Had the movie also ended with work giving Milo an encouraging speech and telling him to like follow his heart, I would have been like, okay, like that's not too, like, he seemed like at times he was pretty okay with Milo. Like, he drifts close enough to being like kind of a little fatherly that it works okay for me.
Oh, his turn personally I thought was fine. And it is like 100% less telegraphed than most Disney villains. I mean, Disney villains will get, like, full entrances to establish, like, look, this guy is full on evil.
Well, now we're big into, like, secret villains, like, a la Frozen,
right.
Wreck-It Ralph. Yeah.
So, obviously, that might have held up better today.
Yeah.
But, no, and that part I was fine with. The only reason why I suspected him immediately is I was like, you know, if you know your fiction, you know that a military presence on an expeditionary force,
exactly,
he's
yeah.
going to probably be the one to turn. So, I mean, his turn I'm fine with. It's the rest of the crew that really throws me that I think is super abrupt. Because I would have killed for a line that was just like, we're in it for the money, but our interests align with yours for right now, so we're fine.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so maybe even Milo could actually have a little bit of an emotional arc and be like, I was really naive before and believed you guys would like stay on the straight and narrow with this, but now I see you're like drawn by greed and money. When I guess that was the case with them the whole time, it just like never came up. Like, that, it's really weird.
Aren't we to assume that everybody's going to get paid anyway? As long as they return?
Except so many people have died.
No.
Right. Yeah. Going back to the crystal, though, because we got off of this again.
Oh, no.
So, in times of crisis, they say, the crystal takes on a host of royal blood. Like,
yes.
Someone from the royal family. Why? Like, why? Someone tell me what that gets the crystal. Like,
also, then, honestly, the comet thing, while that's cool, I have another host of questions. Why
yeah.
did it absorb someone? Is it
yeah.
magical? Is it alien?
Yeah.
And why does Kia's mom never come back?
Yeah.
I feel like that's
well,
such
that's,
a
well,
Disney
she was there
right.
too long, since she got absorbed.
Right, but that's what I'm saying.
I feel like
that's
such a Disney thing to do. Like,
yeah.
reunite the parent with the child.
Yeah, it would be
like,
if she had descended with Kida.
Yeah.
You know?
She
yeah.
also, by the way, Kida did not seem that messed up to not have her mom.
I mean, she's
up,
had thousands of years to adapt.
I guess, but it comes up, like, once, and it's crazy to me that there wasn't a moment where she... I really was expecting for her to be like, oh, I saw my mother up there, and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess that's supposed to be the implication, because she has the bracelet.
Right.
But
it's,
it just would have been nice to get a line.
Yeah, it's like a faint telling, or a faint telling, but not showing.
Right.
Like, or showing, but not telling. Because, like, you get a little bit of it from when you see the bracelet,
yes.
but she never says, like... Mom says hi.
Or just to be like, have her be like, wipe me away a tear and been like, you know,
yeah.
something really big happened for me up there. Like,
yeah.
you know, I mean, I don't need her mom to take her into her spiritual breast, but
mm-hmm.
like, I need a little more.
Kida needs
yeah.
anything she can get.
yeah. So going into characters with this movie, there are some problems, I think, with the two main characters, Milo and Kida, in that they don't have much of a journey and I
no.
don't know what they want.
I feel like this is a problem that we've kind of run up against several times while doing this podcast, where we find a supporting cast very colorful
yeah.
and then the two leads to be very monochrome.
Yeah.
And that's definitely the case here, where, you know, the supporting cast is very archetypal and very broad, but they're entertaining to watch.
Right. I think I remember watching this movie initially and thinking that the supporting cast was very one-note, and to a point they are,
yeah.
but watching it again, they came off as more likable than I remembered them being. Like, they're actually funnier than I remember
yeah.
them
and
being.
And there's a sense
part.
Of fun and adventure to them.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I think what they intended for Milo is to sort of be this, like, lovable goofball, right?
Yeah.
So he's, like, smart, but he's very bumbling, and he's tripping over himself all the time. But it's like it's not enough. Like, there's not much of a person there. And it's not like Michael J. Fox phones it in. I think he does a great job with the voice and conveying that, but it's just Milo as a character.
No, I just... But like Milo at the beginning versus Milo at the end, what has changed? He believes in himself?
He's more physically active?
Yeah.
He has
a better outfit?
Yeah.
I feel like Milo...
No, he does not have a better outfit.
The only thing that changes is that he's kind of manic at the beginning, and, like, when he gets to Atlantis, like, maybe it's, like, his burden is lifted. He no longer has to, like, campaign or discover this thing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, here it is. I'm already here, so I guess I can just be chill.
He's just...
But that's not much.
No.
He's
it's
not
much
fun
not hard.
When he gets to Atlantis. Really.
Yeah, I mean, Milo...
He's not fun and just
no, because he's the cipher, right?
Yeah,
like we have
so
to understand
hard.
Everything
yeah.
through him.
It's such a hard sell for a character, for your main character to be Milo, I think. It's a very difficult sell.
It's weird too, because I would think they could set up that he's very manic and into, you know, exploration, into academics, into linguistics. That would make sense, but then maybe outside of that to be kind of stunted and need to be drawn out of the shell. That would have been an interesting arc. Or maybe he's very impetuous and needs to learn to rein it in. These are like very basic, even just like Disney has done both of those things
yeah.
before. So like...
I mean, I'm almost wondering, and this isn't my fix, like it just came to me right now, sort of. But I'm almost wondering if it was more of an ensemble movie and you weren't following Milo around too directly from the start.
Mm.
Would this be an easier sell? So I'm trying to think
yes.
of movies that have had a character like Milo as the central character and that have done it well. And I've got... Stargate,
mm-hmm.
maybe?
Well, which is, by the way, appropriate because the font of the title card
oh, the
is very Stargate.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think of, like, other movies that have had characters like this. And in all the movies that I can think of, it's, like, it's an ensemble movie or that's the supporting character.
Yeah.
And so when you think of something like Independence Day, where Jeff Goldblum's character is sort of, like, akin to Milo, that he's, like, a little socially awkward but very intelligent.
But Jeff Goldblum is so fucking watchable.
Right, yeah.
Know.
And you have that going for you, but you also have the fact that he's being balanced out with Bill Pullman and Will Smith.
Mm-hmm.
So... You're not just focusing on this one person's journey. You have a little bit from everyone. So maybe if we got a little bit from, like, Helga, a little bit from, you know, Audrey or Sweet or something like that in the beginning as well, you would be a little more okay with Milo not having enough to fully hang, like, an entire arc on, maybe.
Maybe we need, yeah, maybe Milo needs to be one of, like, four characters in the ensemble instead of having... Milo and Keita kind of at the front of the pack, and then, like, the five supporting characters,
and then
everyone
else.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually you mentioned Keita, who I actually think is even less of a character
mm-hmm.
yeah.
than Milo is.
Keita is a MacGuffin for most of the movie.
Honestly, there were times when I was watching this, I was like, it's almost Pocahontas-esque in terms of how, like, flat
well,
and featureless they made
it is. There are a lot of similarities to Pocahontas in this movie, too.
Yes.
In the sense of, like, white people show up in, like, you know, this society that they have no idea what it is, and the two have a sort of, like, a romantic understanding between their two ways, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, the difference here is that this follows more of the, you know, Avatar, Dances with
mm-hmm.
Wolves route, where it's, you know, the white guy shows up and shows them how to do their culture.
Although they phone it the fuck in with that, because by the end of that movie, I didn't believe for a single second that Milo was, like, more at home in Atlantis,
no.
or was going to be happier there, which I could have bought if they had sold him as someone who had, like, oh my god, I knew all this stuff, and this is so great, I get to be here now, but you don't get that at all. He's just there because it's perfunctory.
No, it doesn't, you feel like for a character like that, like, typically when you have a movie where a character goes to a new land or something, and they find themselves, like, more at home there, you show them, I think, feeling more of the sort of awkwardness that they have around the rest of humanity, and you don't 100% get that with Milo. You get that, like, you know, he's not respected at his job, and they sort of think he's a bit of a laughingstock, but you don't really feel like he was 100%, like,
a misfit.
At odds with Earth as we know it.
But just going back to Keita for a second.
Yeah, let's go back to her.
Can you even describe her with personality traits?
She's spunky.
That's kind of it.
It's kind of, in a weird way, like, it's a shame because I like Keita as a concept is an interesting sell for me. Like, you have the ability to do a princess character who is, one, like, a person of color. Like, they're Atlantean,
yes.
so they're not a real race, but they're clearly, like, they're not white. She's voiced by Cree Summer.
Well, they give them physically darker skin than
right.
the people who are showing
yeah,
up.
Yeah, and they have, like, dark skin and white hair. So, like, they're not a real race, but they're clearly, like, they're not white, whatever it is that they are,
mm-hmm.
Atlantean. But, so you have a lot of interesting things working for you there, and that she is, she does show herself in scenes to be capable of defending herself. Like, whenever the, so, like, the mercenaries attack her,
right.
like, she fights them off, or she's,
like,
going to stab one.
That was, like, a scene, though.
No, I know. But you get a little bit of that, but you don't get much else.
It's
yeah.
kind of too bad that they feel like they have to have Keita's father in the mix, because I think that it would be so much more interesting if she were just the leader of the Atlantean.
It's not necessary.
You know, it's trying to give the audience some idea of, like, what she's going through with her father being very weak.
Right. I think the thought is that Kida is defined in the movie more by her relationship with her father, but you don't get enough of that for it to pay off.
Which, by the way, could have been really interesting, because you could have had this movie in which it is a princess having a struggle in a Disney movie, but it's not like, my father's marrying me off to a guy who wants to take over the kingdom. She was just going to take over, period.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's a cool concept. No, really good.
Why wouldn't you just make her the head honcho anyway? Like,
yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. She already is royalty, so the crystal thing works. Like, not a whole lot changes. And
no,
you could still have the whole thing with her mom. Maybe her mother and father are absorbed by the crystal.
I guess
it doesn't change a whole lot.
You needed the dad to be, like, dying exposition.
That's so lame. Such a trope.
I know.
I mean, it's also, it is kind of a shame, though, because I like Leonard Nimoy's performance in the movie a lot. So if you lose the king, you do lose, like, I think a pretty solid performance. By, like, if the king is memorable at all, it's because Leonard Nimoy is very good in the role.
Yeah.
Not because there's anything there.
By the way, I think the voice acting in this movie is incredibly good.
Yeah, it's all across the board.
I think it's a very good cast. Like, I was saying this before, but it's a good balance of, like, actors with names that you know, like James Garner, Michael J. Fox, and... like, you know, actors who are voiceover actors by trade, like Corey Burton and Cree Summer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Cree Summer has done, like, a million things. Corey Burton's a million things. So it's, like, it's nice that they have an opportunity to shine. Like, you know, like, I feel like if this was made today, the temptation would be, like, oh, Rihanna should play Kida or something like that. But, like, they gave it to a voiceover actor. And, like, how nice is that that, like, she gets to be, like, a central character in a Disney movie? And then you also have people like Don DeVello.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the name of the actress who played Howl for Life. I know she played Bill's mom on Freaks and Geeks.
She did. And
Claudia...
something.
Yeah, she's so good in this.
Claudia Christine?
Yeah, Christian or something like that, maybe?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Claudia Christian, I think that is it.
Okay, she's so good in this. Like, she's really... I would obviously, like, I feel like I wouldn't have suspected her, like, to be able to do this sort of thing, but she sells the character so well.
Okay, and I actually, by the way, I thought the animation on her character was a little wonky at times, because it seemed like her face was a sketch that was just, like, always shifting a little or sliding.
Yeah.
But I thought the voice performance was great, and I also really liked her as a character. I noted this to you guys... you know, she's eventually betrayed by James Garner's Rourke up in their hot air balloon.
Sure. Yeah.
And her attachment to him wasn't emotional, and it wasn't like, you betrayed me and I thought you loved me or something like that. When he betrays her, she's like, I thought I was getting a percentage of the money, and kind of like kicks his ass for like a second.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow!
Yeah.
What a great moment to get that character.
And it's also like, I had said this to you, like, and he does effectively kill her. He shoves her off the balloon and she dies shortly thereafter.
Her parting shot, though.
Yeah, the last thing she does is she shoots a flare at the balloon to, like, destroy it. And she has
this amazing, like, hard-boiled look on her face, like, fuck you.
Yeah. And there's never a scene where she, like, turns and is like, sorry, good guys, I fucked up and I apologize to you all. But she, like, she is consistent to the end. Like, I feel like the easy choice would have been to have her at the end be like, I've made a mistake, like, I apologize, please, like, take me with you, good guys, and I'll help you out now. But no, like, she is who she is to the end of the movie, and I respect that choice.
And I'm on board fully for a character who is introduced into the movie by, like, a few shafts of moonlight in, like, a fur coat. What was it even? Like, she had, like, a fur hat on, and...
Yeah.
Wasn't she, like, leaned back in the chair, like, smoking?
Yeah, she had, like, one of her, like, dress straps was, like, slightly off.
That keeps happening throughout the movie. Her tank top or whatever strap she's wearing is always, like, coming off.
Do you feel like the animators were like, she looks too hard, we need to soften her a little?
Maybe.
But anyway, it's an amazing entrance, and I thought the character was refreshing.
Yeah.
And how it dealt with... I don't know, her femininity, her place in this world, I loved it.
No, she's very strong, but she's also very feminine. It's a good combination.
Are there any other characters? Oh, I thought Jim Varney was great.
I mean, again, everyone's
great.
Like, this is his last role. He didn't complete all of his line readings for the movie, so one of the lines is done by a voice double. He's quite good in it. I mean, he has a voice that lends itself well to animation, like, as witnessed by Slinky Dog in the Toy Story movies.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he just has, like, a very sort of, like, warm, like, characterful voice. Like, it really was just, like... I feel like when you see him on screen, it's kind of hard to disassociate him with, like, the earnest persona that he's had for so many years. So, like, it's nice that he's able to, like, use his talents, like, as voiceover. And I think he does it very well.
I think it's an effective choice. I think we also need to touch on everyone's favorite character.
Mrs. Packard?
Mrs. Packard.
Yeah. Mrs. Packard's a great character.
She is the bone-dry Greek chorus that we all need. In our lives, but also just to be
She's consistently funny throughout the movie. Like, she's talking on, like what is the device that she's talking on with, like, her friend? Like, it's like...
like an intercom.
Yeah, like, it's all, like, it must be, like, a telephone.
Like a switchboard.
Yeah, she's at the switchboard. She's, like, talking to a friend of hers. And, like, when the sun is going down, she says something like, he took his bags. Margie, I don't think he's coming back. It's just, like, it's just such a great... It's just something, like, she's like... I'll call you back. No. I'll call you. Like, as the stuff is going down, it's just, she's, all of her lines are so great. She has wonderful readings.
She always looks so droll. She always, I feel like, is, like, keeping a cigarette between her lips as she's talking.
It's nice that there's a lot of pressure, obviously, in movies today for characters to not smoke. And I feel like she would have lost something if she didn't have that cigarette hang out of her mouth the entire time.
Me too.
Like, it's just, it feels just, like, so perfect for, like, this sort of, like, old character who, like, doesn't want to deal with any shit whatsoever to just be sitting there with a cigarette hanging out of her mouth.
This would have been, like, I feel like this is one of the last kids' movies that has a smoking character.
I can't think
I'm sorry,
of
multiple smoking characters. There
yeah.
are multiple
yeah,
people smoking puffs.
Well, okay,
well,
some people look like they're smoking
Vinny
cigarettes.
Vinny has a match in his
Vinny
mouth.
Vinny has a match,
yeah.
And I think that you see Rourke with a toothpick.
I think Cookie is also smoking at
doesn't someone have a cigar, maybe?
A
I don't
pipe?
Remember. I don't
Cookie,
think
so. Okay, Cookie might have a pipe.
I don't remember.
Don't you feel like that would fit?
Yeah.
If I'm making it up, I'm making a very correct character choice.
It works.
Yeah.
It works.
This is...
Although, you know what? Probably not. I bet Jim Varney was like, I won't voice the character, because by that point, he was already doing anti-smoking ads.
Mm.
Like Yul Brynner.
Anywho.
Don't smoke.
Thanks, Yul.
No? Okay.
Thanks, Yul. But yeah, no, she's hysterical. And
yeah.
She always has, like, a dry cutting line to, like, emphasize a scene.
Or just to, like, deflate the, like, seriousness of what's happening.
I could
like,
have used more.
Yeah, oh, I could have too. She's good.
She should have been the main character.
She's who I want.
I'm only half joking. Like, what if the entire story were told through her eyes?
Maybe she's sort of like, maybe like this woman who's like, her husband died like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And she's been working like as a switchboard operator for some big company
that?
All this time. And then like, she just gets drafted to go on overseas adventure. She's like, okay. Like,
could you imagine that as it would almost be like a gender flipped up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Like, she's... I mean, funnier, I think, but she's like so grumpy and over it, and
yeah.
just like
yeah.
Well, she, you know, this mission's like crazy. Who knows if she's even going to come home?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. She might be perfect. She might have made her peace with God.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Yeah. All
right, so we've covered Atlantis. We've covered, I think, the voice acting, the character and character development.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you guys want to say about the look of the movie, just in general?
I'm really disappointed we didn't get more time with that really cool-looking submarine.
Oh, it hates
yeah.
me!
The Ulysses... Okay, so there is such pomp and circumstance around the launching of the Ulysses.
There's also a lot of pomp and circumstance, I feel like, when they even just reveal the models.
They build
like,
that up
yeah.
so
of, like,
yeah.
of the whole,
yeah.
like,
it gets a big reveal,
yeah.
it gets a big orchestral fanfare.
And by the way, everything looks great.
Yeah.
I am there for all of those.
And the sequence
vehicles.
Of the Ulysses launching, it's such, like, it's such a, I hate to say epic, but it's a very
yeah.
epic
yes.
sequence. Like, you have this great tracking shot of the Ulysses, like, sinking in water, the camera pans past, like, the bubble where you see Milo with his hands pressed against the glass, and then it, like, follows it down as it sinks into the ocean, and it's done with like such like importance, and you're like, oh wow, like this is
it's,
such a cool ship.
It's thrilling.
Yeah. And then the Ulysses lasts maybe 5 to 7
and they abandon it so
yeah.
fast.
Yeah.
Oh, and so many people are dead.
Yeah.
So many people
let
are
it,
dead.
Let it not be said that this movie takes a lot of chances for killing people, I think.
There was a shot straight up, and I think it was one of you guys commented on this. But there's a shot of, I think it's Audrey.
Oh, she's closing like a door.
Is closing like a flood door
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
And one guy gets through, but another one does not.
Yeah, you see the guy like jumping toward the door as it slams shut. And you feel like...
And you're just like, that guy is dead.
Yeah, the obvious Disney thing would to be like, oh, he gets through just at the end. And he's like, woo! But, you know, you see him, like, he is in a chamber rapidly filling with water. He dead.
And this movie is just like, moving on.
Yeah.
But some of the characters, which I found a little strange...
I get
that they're mercenaries, but, like, it doesn't even register with Milo of, like, those people are dead.
No, the most... You get Sweet, like, putting a candle,
candle
in the
thing, yeah.
and then, like, sending it off.
I liked Sweet.
I like Sweet, too.
He was Sweet.
So, Sweet is your doctor? Your doctor is Sweet.
Oh my God! There's a very terrible, like, Who's on First style exchange between Milo and Hita that the movie seems to think is hilarious, but it is. It's not. It's so god-awful. Our doctor is Sweet.
But
so,
he's also kindly. Cookie, like, but she says, like, Cookie is your doctor? He's like, no, our doctor's Sweet. He's like, oh, he's kindly. No, his name is Sweet, so all your doctors are Sweet? Like,
no, but Audrey is Sweet,
yeah.
but Audrey's not your doctor.
Yeah.
It was just like...
Although, to like, when she says, like, Mole is your pet, I was like, okay, like, that's a good line to end it on.
And thank God they do.
Yeah.
Because it does not go beyond
no,
that.
No, it cannot support itself beyond that.
Do you think that they even had, like, was the whole vehicle thing, was Ulysses there, was that just to sell toys? Like, what the
I
fuck?
Mean, I don't...
It's just such a bummer.
To a point... I always suspect that's the thing, but I feel like there were no toys made of
I don't
Ulysses.
Remember. a lot of toys.
Like, I feel like if there are toys made, like, it's like action figures.
Yeah.
But I feel like a playset like that is a very difficult sell.
Yeah.
Like, because that's going to be a fucking huge playset. Like, you could maybe get, like, a sub pod.
It's just so fucking disappointing.
No, it is, like, and once, honestly, once the Ulysses goes down, it's just, like, a real quick, like, moving past, like, plot points, like running full barrel toward Atlantis at that point. It's like, but we have to get past the fireflies, the, like, things on fire, and we have to get past, like, this big centipede thing, and it's winter now, and there are, like, there's all this other crap. It's just, like, when I was watching the documentary, I told you guys this also.
Mm-hmm.
When the two directors and the producer were sort of talking about, like, what they wanted to do as a movie, because the team had done Beauty and the Beast, and they had done Hunchback of Notre Dame. And so
they had some hits under
the
belt.
And so they wanted to do something that's very different, and I don't begrudge them that.
Yeah.
I understand that. And so the thing that they had initially hit upon was maybe doing Journey to the Center of the Earth as a movie. And as they got toward, like, discussing that more, they just, it wasn't really working for them. But they liked the idea of people going into the Earth. And then at a certain point, they were like, oh, well, at one point in the book, they go to Atlantis, but it's a real quick chapter because, you know, nothing's there. It's just like an underwater city. Everyone's dead. And so they just run through it. But they're like, what if Atlantis is the thing they're going to? So they had this, like, these combating ideas of, like, people go into the Earth, but now also they find Atlantis. So it's like, you have to imagine if they're hung up on, like, oh, we like the idea of them traveling into the Earth and meeting all these bugs and dinosaurs and things like that, then that's something that's going to be in the movie. But contrary-wise, when you say your movie is called Atlantis, The Last Empire, I feel like I expect there to be a lot of shit underwater.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't expect there to be that much footage of them fighting monsters and fireflies
right.
and weird things inside the Earth.
Although it is kind of a nice twist, I guess. That
it's
it,
not
it,
a bad
if
idea.
If you're going to subvert it and, like, oh, you thought it would be underwater, well, fuck you, it's not.
It's not a bad idea, but I think you can really see how there are different ideas at odds here with what, like, with what they wanted it to be, you know? Like, you can definitely see how they wanted this to be a story of people going inside the Earth.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, oh, also, it's Atlantis, so I guess they should probably get to Atlantis soon.
It's interesting to me, actually, now that you say it out loud, that the people who did this movie were also behind Beauty and the Beast and Hunchback. Because I would actually say both of those movies, I guess less so Beauty and the Beast, more so Hunchback, kind of let in slightly darker or more modern notes into their movies. I think, like, Belle was probably one of, I mean, Stockholm Syndrome aside, was probably one of the more...
I'm not having this argument.
I know, but I'm just saying, one of the more well-written female characters.
She's
but,
a more headstrong woman who, like, takes charge of her own fate.
Right, and then in Hunchback, there was, like, that movie is way darker and lustier than I ever remember it being as
yeah.
a kid. So it's just interesting to me then that it seems natural to me that they're going to be like, we want to do something different, we want to do something more teen level,
mm-hmm.
that's more action-y. I get that progression. I think that's actually quite natural. It's just such a shame that this is where we landed.
It
yeah.
also feels like Disney just was not ready to commit to something like that at that point in their history. Like, you feel like this is probably happening, like, toward the tail end of, like, what was called the Disney Renaissance,
mm-hmm.
where you have things like, you know, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast,
right.
Little Mermaid, Lion King, Pocahontas,
just
where they're all, like, big musicals,
hit,
right? But they're all, like, big musicals based off of stories that people know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an action movie, and it's an original story, and it's just, like, maybe, like, I'm sure Disney was at a certain point, like, okay, well, you've given us two hits, so, like, go do your thing. But I feel like maybe they were just kind of, like, dipping their toes in the water and being like, ooh, it's too cold.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that probably Katzenberg not being there had a lot to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a musical. When Katzenberg came in, he very strictly had everybody adhere to more traditional development of the story
right.
and the structure of the narrative and, you know, things kind of split into acts and distribution of songs like you would in a Broadway show.
Yeah.
So Katzenberg's not there with that influence. But at the same time, I feel like towards the tail end of the 90s, by the time Atlantis was in development, they probably already knew that they were hitting diminishing returns
yeah.
on their one-per-year big musical event.
Right. I mean,
number.
But, like, because, like, they knew that, frankly, from Pocahontas on
yeah.
at that point. Because they knew, like, Lion King was, like, the apex of, like, what they could do at the time, financially speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, everything after that was doing, like, a little bit less good than the previous one.
So that in their situation, what you're proposing is they probably feel like we need to take a big swing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm sure they're feeling pressure from, like, DreamWorks, which is doing things like, you know, like, Shrek had come out probably, or, like, Shrek was in development
around
by that point.
At the same time,
yeah.
right?
So, like,
same year as Shrek.
Yeah, and so
yeah.
DreamWorks was already an established studio by this point. So, like, they had to sort of feel like, well, maybe we should try and shake it up a little bit,
mm-hmm.
too. But I feel like the Disney of today, if the Disney of today said, oh, we're doing a movie about Atlantis, and it's an action movie, and there's no singing, I'd be like, yeah, okay. Like, Zootopia was, like, a surprisingly smart take on, like, race relations, and there's,
oh.
like, there's, like, no singing in it. So, like, I feel like,
and it's also,
yeah.
like, a really well-done film noir story.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And, like, Big Hero 6 is, like, it's an action movie, and there's a good emotional core. So,
mm-hmm.
like, following those movies, I'd be like, yeah, okay, like, sure, you guys can do something like that. Of course, why couldn't you? But, like, back then, I remember even thinking, like, as a kid when this was coming out, I was like, this is a weird choice for them to do.
So maybe then, ultimately, it becomes super fitting that us, your third favorite movie podcast, coming along to try to figure out how to fix it. It's super appropriate because we're all coming into this with more modern eyes and takes, I think. We are essentially going to try to honor the idea that perhaps Atlantis, the Lost Empire, was just made too soon.
Yeah, and I think that they had conflicting impulses on what to do. They wanted it to be more mature, and they wanted it to, you know, what was the slogan on the
first? Less singing, more explosions.
Less singing, more explosions.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the impulses in the animation and the development of the art style just didn't quite mesh with the idea
right.
of what
they're
people expect
like,
from an action
yeah.
film.
Mole is more of a goofy traditional Disney sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
Cookie even to an extent too. And so it's you can see like their base instincts coming into play here.
That you're right. They injected some softness into it.
Yeah. Which, and it ends up being Kiji anyway, so
yeah.
I don't know. It's weird. I feel like,
yeah.
if you're talking about like a more adult story around this time period, I feel like both, and I don't want to say like this is a controversial take because I hate fucking doing that, but like I feel like both Lilo and Stitch and Treasure Planet pull this sort of thing off better than Atlantis end up doing
yes.
because they both have very strong emotional centers. And
I
so
agree.
Like Lilo and Stitch, that we've all seen it, like there's no
mm-hmm.
need to recap the movie. Like it does a lot of things very, very well that you might not expect. Treasure Planet, what I think Treasure Planet does very well is it does the relationship between Jim and Long John Silver very well. Like Long John Silver is a very good, I think it's a hard character to get right because like he's the villain, but you
yeah.
also have to kind of like him in that movie
for
also.
For a great deal
yeah.
of the story, you have to like
him. Right, and in that movie also, he's also like a father figure to Jim. So it's like you have to tread the line very delicately between being a bad guy and being someone that like, you're like looking at it being like, oh God, like why can't you be like what this kid wants you to be? And I think Treasure Planet pulls that off very well. Like there are other problems with the movie, to be sure, but I think it does that much better than Atlantis can.
I was going to say, I thought Treasure Planet better nailed its visual style than
it's more cohesive.
Than
it is more, yeah.
I thought it was more cohesive, and I also thought they decided we're going in this direction and this is what we're doing.
Oh my gosh. I kept thinking during this movie, where have I seen Milo's hair? It's the same as Jim. Has the same
Doesn't
name.
Jim have, like, a rat tail?
Holy
I think so, too.
Shit,
yeah.
you're
yeah.
right. The one difference is he has a little, like, rat tail
yeah.
thing.
He has a rat tail. He does have, like, a floppy hair.
Oh, my God. Who wore it better?
I mean, maybe, like, in a weird way, though, similar to, like, what we said with Attack of the Clones, like, maybe Disney had to do this in order to, like, figure out
Treasure Planet.
How to make, like, a better, like, more grown-up animated feature, you know?
It just sucks because there is, I think, a great deal of potential here.
No, as we said, there's much to like in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, I feel, we're ragging on it a lot, but there are, like...
Because there's a lot to not
yeah,
like
I know,
too.
Because, like, the biggest issue is story problems, which is
yeah.
a big part of a movie, and it makes it hard to sit back and enjoy. But there are so many elements that do work well.
Mm-hmm.
There's one last thing I kind of want to get to, and we had talked about the opening of the movie. So, as you said, Chris, during the recap, the movie opens with a flashback to Atlantis sinking.
Yeah.
Where Kida's mother is absorbed into the crystal. The entire city goes underwater due to some, you know, nebulous accident, blah, 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 blah. There is also on the DVD and on the Blu-ray an alternate opening that they had entirely animated, scored, edited, everything like that. Like, it is done. Where it's a Viking ship traveling in the sea, and they have the Shepherd's Journal with them, and the leader of the ship is talking about how, like, oh, like, we're going to find Atlantis, and someone else is like, oh, but there are monsters and scary things outside Atlantis. He's like, I don't care! And they're sailing off, and then the Leviathan...
And then immediately a Leviathan just, like, crunches.
Right, well, I do kind of like, there's a shot, like, Leviathan, like, jumping out of the ocean over the ship, and it's just, like, it's
yes.
kind of, like, a surprising amount of grace for a large, like, vehicle. But, okay, wait, actually, sidebar.
Was it a vehicle or was it a monster?
Is it a robot? No, is it a robot or
it's
are
mechanical.
They operating it? It's like it's mechanical.
Except the thing that is attacking their boat is clearly like organic tentacles.
Yeah, but it's like, but they say it's a, Milo says it's a machine. Like he straight up says it in the movie. So like my question is it a robot, like is it an automaton or are there Atlantean pilots?
I think it's autonomous.
Okay, that's what I'm...
I think it's an automaton.
So I don't think the Atlanteans leave.
Right, that's what I'm confused about.
Also,
yeah.
Would that not be crazy if they're like, we know how to pilot our giant Leviathan, we have no idea how the rest of this technology
yeah.
works.
But it is weird to me that they would create this like Leviathan and be like, okay, like, go for it.
Like, but wait, okay, alright, this is a deep plot issue now, because how did they plant this Leviathan after
yeah.
the city?
Well, okay,
they don't...
Wait, maybe the Leviathan... So you see the Leviathan getting, like, overcome by the tidal wave, right?
Yeah.
Maybe the Leviathan was just separate and just hanging around outside Atlantis.
Oh.
Maybe it has, like, a contingency
oh,
protocol
okay, okay,
to defend
okay, okay.
the city.
So,
like
so,
this is a tremendous reach for the
cookie. Yeah.
Okay, so just to recap here, what you are suggesting, which sounds very plausible, is that the island of Atlantis, when it was not sunk into the earth,
yeah.
has a huge automaton monster
yeah.
that just swims around the island.
It flies, too.
It flies?
You see it flying in the beginning.
It flies.
Oh,
yeah.
You do. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, it comes like straight at the camera.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So
then is that the only reason why it's sticking around underwater? Is because it's just staying in the water around the area where the
that is literally see like the thing is like
that
okay,
is
so it's a problem, right? Because like if it's a robot, why is it doing this? And
yeah.
If it's piloted by an Atlantean, why are they there and why aren't they going to the surface and how do they get there? Like there's so many questions.
Is it powered by the crystal?
Yeah.
But isn't it too far away?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is it programmed to... programmed. But is it programmed to be always at, like, the rim of the crystal's influence?
That's a big distance, though. They kick across... Okay. I realize we were telling the prologue, but the Leviathan makes no sense. Anyhow. So, you see...
It is a cool shot,
yes.
Though. Because, ostensibly, those Vikings don't see the Leviathan jumping over them because, A, it's dark, and...
Stormy.
B,
yeah.
It's very stormy, so the... Like, the splashdown of that would be covered up by the storm.
Right, you just, like, you see it very smoothly, like, just, like, bloop,
it's
and, like,
kind of
dive over.
It's scary
yeah,
a little.
Yeah, it is. It's one of the, like, there are a few shots of the Leviathan. Like, I think also the initial shot of the Leviathan where you see, like, not the initial one, but, like, the second one where you see the Ulysses, like, swimming, and then underneath it, like, the Leviathan, like, goes underneath and, like, swarms around
yeah.
it. Like, it's a pretty neat-looking shot.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so the Leviathan attacks the ship, and, like, as the Norse captain's like, damn you, like, I'm going to go to Les, blah, blah, blah. It destroys the entire ship, and, like, a severe moment of overkill, like, shoots its Atlantean laser beam at it, like destroys
it's,
it.
Oh, it's a gigantic
oh my God.
Explosion!
Yeah.
Like mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe you and I, guest friend, both exclaimed
yeah.
out loud when it happened. Like, whoa!
Yeah.
Like,
as that happens, the Shepherd's Journal flies off of the boat and like
then we kind of zoom in,
yeah,
like
loops
the
into
sigil.
The water, and then you see it. How is that thing not waterlogged by this point? Like, if it's scrolls that have been rebound into a book or something, like, that should be gone.
See, I was glad I saw that alternate opening, because it really reaffirmed, I was like, we got the better one.
Yeah, so there, so...
But is it that much better?
Well, see, that's, so, the understanding...
Not that much,
also
but, it is,
problem,
but it is better.
The understanding from the documentary is that that initial opening was jettisoned because they felt that the audience was not introduced to the Atlanteans soon enough, and that they wanted a connection with Kida earlier on, because also Kida doesn't show up until very late in the movie. And I feel like there are some correct impulses
mm-hmm.
there to want to feature the Atlanteans and to introduce you to them, to show their society what it was like before it all went to pot. But contrary-wise, it's confusing.
It is. It really is. I think that if they had spent... Jeez Louise, everything in this movie is like, it feels so rushed and compressed.
Mm.
You don't have a second to breathe.
Mm.
And this alternate opening suffered from the same problem.
Very airless.
It feels like they cut anything out that didn't need to be there. You know, like, you don't need to see the book in the ocean. Why don't you just extend the sequence by a couple of minutes so that there are survivors and they wash up on shore and one of them is carrying the book?
Right.
Yeah.
And that's when you cut to the title.
Yeah, the
like,
Shepherd's
that doesn't take hardly any more time.
To a lesser point than the crystal, but similar, the Shepherd's Journal is also under the extent of, like, oh, we're not going to answer any questions about
yeah.
where this is or where it came from.
Yeah.
It's the book. Just go with it.
Just go with it.
Yeah. And so, like,
it's our plot coupon. We got like a movie.
What Shepherd? Who
yeah.
knows?
Yeah. Who wrote this? Where'd it come from? Why
that
is it here?
My question, too. I was like, is Shepherd a person? Was that his job title?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the fuck?
I think, like, it's a neat name for a book.
Yeah,
because
totally.
It has, like, if you see that, it's like, ooh, that sounds cool. What's its story? No.
You don't get to know that.
We got a submarine to launch here, guys.
Here's my contention. We need an Atlantis opening.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't have that, and then we're going in to restore the Empire to what it was, and we don't know, we have no idea what the fuck that is,
yeah.
then I'm not interested.
But what if we had...
Because then we have a Tomorrowland problem.
Yeah, we do.
True,
and it
true.
Has some similar problems with that. But what if we have the Vikings on the ship before they're attacked, they're looking at this book, they're looking at the pictures, and like figuring out what the story of
Atlantis
was.
Perfect. I'm into it. Because then you might think... You get something, but there's still a mystery.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
it doesn't spill the goods like first thing where you get to see what all the people look like and what the place.
And then
looks
and then
like.
To be killed by some strange mechanical creature.
Yeah,
right
what's going on here?
Ooh, what's going on here? It's is Atlantis like a sinister place?
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, what if? Okay, so my assumption is for the Shepherd's Journal, incidentally, and like. I think they might have touched this in the documentary, is that it is literally, like, a shepherd who found Atlantis. And, like, I think this is when it was above ground.
Cool.
And so it was just some guy who, like, wandered and was like, oh, what a cool place. Do-do-do-do-do-do and wrote down, like, everything about it. So what if, like, the action sequence at the beginning is, like, that guy and, like, a bunch of people, and he's like, guys, I know we all heard what happened, but I was here 20 years ago. Atlantis is right here. And he's, like, going through the books.
I'm
and
into it.
Like,
yeah,
so, like,
I like that.
Your source is not just the fact you have the book. You have the actual guy who wrote the book being like, no, like, there was a crystal. It was amazing. Like, it was beautiful. It gave them all, like, energy. It kept them alive. Like, it should be here.
It has that first-hand link to the Atlanteans, so at least you have some tenuous... line there.
Also, then you're building yourself in some vagary later if when you decide, oh, fuck, this crystal is whatever I need it to be. I know what I'll do. I'm going to slip a passage in the Shepherd's Journal that just says the crystal is buh, 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 buh. And then that's how you can have your main character be like, I'm not really sure, but this is what the journal said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something. I feel like we've started to drift into fixes.
No, we have. And just real quickly, in terms of looking to score,
yeah.
It's a really good soundtrack.
It's great.
James Newton Howard did it. He also, for Disney, he did Dinosaur,
mm-hmm.
and he did Treasure Planet. Treasure Planet's another very good Disney score, and Dinosaur is, it's better than the movie. Take that as you will.
But it's a very good adventure track.
Yeah, there's a lot of good themes to it. There's sort of like there's like a main like adventure theme, and there's like an Atlantis kind of theme that play into it. And it's it's I think perhaps a little more interesting in terms of the choices of instruments used than you might think. There's a lot of choral work. There's a lot of neat. I think it's also again they sort of went to like a Southeast Asian sort of like
mm-hmm.
feel for some of the instruments used in the scoring of the Atlantis sequence. And it's a neat choice, I think. I think the score is one of the other things I can wholeheartedly recommend about the movie. Just, that's about it. It's good.
Yeah.
Not much bad to say about it, really.
Yeah.
And a credit song. I don't remember it at all. It's boring. Who cares?
It's very much of its time, I feel like, when they were like, who do we got on the pop roster to
yeah.
come sing?
Oh,
that was Maya.
Maya?
Was...
Okay, cool. Send her in.
Exactly.
Yeah. I digress. So now that we sort of veered into this territory anyway, we should go into fixes,
yeah.
I think. Does
Ooh.
Anyone want to start in particular? Because I can if you guys...
I can start. So I'm just going to invoke the absent Lee, who I know will appreciate, who would have appreciated this out loud with me. But there's a video game that she and I have both played together and really, really enjoyed that's called Renowned Explorer. And it captures... So Renowned Explorer it's a very large cast of these sort of broad, archetype-y... goofy characters from different places, and they have very distinct looks and silhouettes and stuff going on, and you assemble a team out of them to go in search of these impossible places. And so, like, Shangri-La is a place you'll visit, or something like that. It's a lot of fun, and it's very light and doesn't take itself very seriously. If I was going to kind of redo Atlantis, I would try to bring it closer to that game, or to that one's approach of just keeping it very light, very broad, and just making a really good adventure. I think, though, the largest thing I would change about it is I don't think I would make it a movie.
Oh, interesting. You're going cross-media.
I'm going cross-media.
You're going to make it a podcast?
I'm going to make it a radio drama.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this really visual movie would look best with just audio.
Hey, Packard, who's that on the radio?
Hey, it's me, Packard. No.
Miss Mom?
I actually think, you know, in this age of, like, Netflix and Amazon picking up all these different series, and Netflix, by the way, later this year is putting out an animated version of Castlevania.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, if we're getting these streaming services that are getting in the business of doing, quote-unquote, prestige animated projects,
mm-hmm.
I think this would be great for them. Because then you can spend a ton of time on this mythology that I actually think, from what you see, it looks quite rich. It would be a lot of fun to play with. You could get to know a lot of these characters a lot more. You could even expand the cast and cycle through them a little more, which is sort of what gets into the video game aspect of it, because there are so many characters, but it would give you a chance and, you know, X number of episodes to play around with different people and different adventures. And it could also maybe give a little bit more to do with the adventure itself, not just have it be like, we're gone, and then 10 minutes later in movie time, we're at Atlantis. That's bananas. There should be a lot more getting there, fighting around, finding stuff, having many adventures, learning things about each other, establishing new dynamics and relationships between these characters.
It's interesting what you say about pacing, actually, because I do, like, as we established, that's a problem of the movie, but I do think it's a problem that is difficult to quite fix, because you do want to
spend time, changing media.
You do want to spend time with these characters getting to Atlantis, because you don't want it to be, like, so easy, where it's like, oh, poop, we're at Atlantis, but contrary-wise, you don't want to be the entire movie, be like, when are they going to get to the fireworks factory?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And that's what also sort of threw me off, too, is when I was reading the Wikipedia article about it, one of the guys involved was saying, like, you know, we just had so much screen time to spend with these characters. I was like, but not really, and then you didn't.
Well, see, like, because, like, they did do weird things. Like, it all mentioned, like you said...
Yeah,
like,
they spent a long time, and ostensibly that is... And the characters do kind of be like, here's my backstory.
Right, like, it's a very, like, screenwriting 101 way for characters to introduce themselves, where they're like, hey, they literally say, like, what's your story at some point? Where they're like, oh, okay, like, this is my backstory, this is my dad, I did this before I went to here. Do you want to go or should
I? I'll go, I feel like you have a lot more to talk about.
I got some stuff.
Yeah, you've got some notes. I was worried going into it that you didn't have a lot typed up already. And
no, I didn't, and then this all just like crapped out of me as I was sitting here writing.
Yeah. For me, I want to solve a lot of the problems that I have with the beginning of the movie. I think that it just feels like it's going through the motions, getting the team together, and then conveniently the team's already together, and oh, here's the submarine, it's already ready. Cut all that nonsense. Let's start with some sort of a framing device so that we can get to know Milo, where he's writing in his diary. Maybe his, you know, maybe his grandfather or, you know, whatever character he has in his family that we use kind of as a crutch to develop his character here. What if they're alive and he's kind of journaling to them? So you have him as the main character, but he's writing to somebody else to describe this adventure that they're going on. And I'd also like to take a page out of, like, this is a weird idea that I came up with, but let's copy Prometheus a little bit.
Something no one has ever said.
Prometheus.
No, this. Hey, there are things like this movie. Visually, looks great.
Yeah.
Story-wise,
so I want to open the movie with everybody already in place on the submarine. We don't waste any time getting there. We don't make a big show about getting there. We're on a giant, awesome submarine. Like, let's go on this adventure. I feel like what they do in this film to get you to the submarine is so rushed that you might as well not even go through it. You might as well go like, oh, and, you know, yesterday we got the crew together and we did some preliminary training and we made sure the life pods worked, haha. So, you know, you have some interactions between the crew on the ships. You get to enjoy the ship. You get to do that world building. You get to see kind of the technology that they're getting to work with. You get to see the strengths of all the different characters.
And you show
while
the relationships
the ship.
Organically through
exactly.
the interactions.
They're all cooped up on this small space together, and they need to learn how to work as a team. And then you have, you know, the Leviathan attack. And, you know, well, first of all, you need some sort of a briefing. This is what made me think of Prometheus. You should have a briefing on the ship to give the exposition to the audience so that, you know, your team members in the film, all those characters are on the same page, but the audience also knows what the hell's going on. And then a lot of the film unfolds the way that it unfolds. I just want to spend more time getting a sense of awe. I feel like everything is so... It's just all the energy is expended getting us to Atlantis that we don't get a chance to stop and breathe. And I think that some of that is like, well, how many different interiors of a cave can you show, right? but I think that there are probably other more creative solutions to just trudging through the cave and, oh, we'll let Mole use the drilling machine and, oh, we'll blow this up. Like, you know.
Everyone gets like their little moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody gets a little moment, but it's, you know, it's not that interesting. So I think that once we get to Atlantis, like kind of like I said before, I don't think that I would have Kida have a father. I think that I would have Kida as the head of this tribe of lost Atlanteans who have forgotten their past, forgotten their culture. From the briefing earlier on, we know from Milo's extensive, exhaustive, obsessive research that this giant apocalyptic event happened and sort of, you know, you get a sense of the history, but you also get a sense for, you know, the technology and the MacGuffins that you're going to encounter later on. Like the fact that Kida, you know, would need to join with the crystal in order to, you know, let's say 1-to-1 ratio. Kida joins with the crystal only when they need to summon those giant guardians. That's the only reason why you do that.
Those guardians come out of nowhere.
They do. That's not really well explained. So that as their defensive mechanism needs to be better explained ahead of time, so that when it happens, we understand what the stakes are and what's going on.
That actually, like, not to interrupt, but like now that you say that would actually be kind of a cool mythology thing. It's like, a lot of them are underwater, which I do like. You only see, like, the top of their head, so it's like, oh, like, it's a weird little just, like, Rocky thing. But, like, if there were sort of, like, these enormous stone statues throughout the city, and, like, Milo's like, oh, what are these things? She's like, well, like, they're said to be the guardians of Atlantis, but, like,
I never seen
them
move.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think it's just, like, you know, like, I guess they're supposed to be statues of, like, our gods or something. So, like, I guess that's what they are. And then you find out at the end, like, no, they straight up, like, they're enormous, like, Rocky robots.
Mm-hmm. And that's such a cool imagery. That's such a cool image at the end of all of the guardians standing around the rim of the thing. Like, all that stuff is really good, but it feels like it's not something that we're, you know, that is earned by the movie. It's a cool image just for the sake of having a cool image. It doesn't tie into anything deeper. So I really wanted to strengthen that. But other than that, like, I really don't have a whole lot of input for the ending. I think that I want Kida to do more. I don't want her to just be a pushover that they just, like, lock in a box for the entire climax.
Oh, we didn't mention that. That drove me so fucking crazy.
So, yeah.
She's
think,
so passive.
Exactly. I think that I would have her much more active in the unlocking and the rediscovering of the Atlantean technology and culture. Because, as it stands, Milo is having to hold her hand and, like, show these, like, bewildered, like, doe-eyed people, like, oh, you just turn the key. Oh, I can read that sign. Yeah, I'll read it. Like, there really isn't anything interesting there. Again, with, like, the sense of awe and wonder, the sense of discovery, that's what kills me about this movie, is that it should give you that feeling, and it completely punts on it.
So I have, a lot of this was kind of just like a stream of consciousness kind of thing where I just started writing down ideas that I was having for the movie. So I don't know, I don't know if any of these sort of like hang well together or anything like that. But the general idea that I had, first of all, is the movie should be very steeped in this sort of World War I era that it is, that like movie kind of mentions a little bit, alludes to a little bit, but doesn't quite...
With the word Kaiser. Really.
Yeah, I think it should be more maybe like how Raiders of the Lost Ark is very clearly like, I mean, obviously it's different there because that's dealing directly with Nazis, but like you never forget that like this is the time period.
Yeah.
So like something like that. The intro should feature the Atlantis Cataclysm, but it should also be happening, like we don't need to see anyone being absorbed into the crystal. We need to see the shepherd writing in his journal. And as he's like finishing this up, like the city is being destroyed. And he's like, oh shit, I have to hurry. I have to leave. He drowns when the city is destroyed and his journal like floats up to the surface. So you, I think one of like the biggest things is like this shepherd's journal, like there's no focus on it. And it's brushed aside so very quickly where Milo says like, this is a thing I want. And Whitmore's like, here it is. I found it.
Well, it's
like,
just really supposed to be like the Rosetta Stone. That...
Yeah. So the other thing that I thought from the beginning is, I was basing this kind of off of the book 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where at the beginning there is the Nautilus is sort of like attacking ships, and everyone's like, ooh, is it a narwhal? Like, is there a grumpy narwhal in the ocean? And so I kind of like the idea that maybe that like the Leviathan has like attacked a boat or something that was getting too close to Atlantis, and everyone's like, oh, like, holy shit, what's this going on? And like all of Milo's coworkers are like, hey, remember that like stupid thing your grandfather was looking for? Like, ooh, it looks like they sent a creepy monster to the surface. And Milo's like, okay, like, fuck you, I get it. I also think Milo should be more annoyed by his grandfather's history. Like, maybe like he resents the fact kind of that his grandfather is looked upon as a lunatic who spent his life finding Atlantis, and Milo wants to be taken very seriously as like a linguist. So he's like, look, like I know that you guys associate me with this, but like I'm very good with like I'm big with facts, I'm big with things that are real, things that I can see, like. Please don't mention Atlantis to me whatsoever. Helga should arrive with the journal to tempt Milo because, again, I want to keep the focus on the journal a little bit more earlier on in the beginning. So she shows up with the journal and then says, like, rich guy wants to give you money. Come with me. Here's the journal. Going back to sort of Atlantis, the way I want Atlantis to work is that, first of all, the crystal is a power source. It doesn't grant long life. Everyone has normal lifespans there. The king, thousands of years ago, tried to use it as a weapon to sort of conquer more of, you know, the world. I feel like the movie kind of alludes to this, doesn't go out right and say it. Like, it says that there was some sort of, like, cataclysm that that arose from the king using it as a weapon. But I want this to more directly be, like, the king used it as a weapon and it just really fucking backfired on him. Like, it looks like there's a wave coming from far away or something. So, like, it's kind of confusing.
Isn't there kind of, like, a battle happening? It almost...
I guess, like, because there are so many ships, like, running toward Atlantis.
Ships.
So,
yeah.
Like, it feels like there was a battle that happened far away and they did something with a crystal and then, like, uh-oh! And then everyone's running in toward the city. So, like, I want, like, ideally the king was, like, doing something in the city to use it as a weapon and it just backfired immensely and the entire city just, like, just sunk below the surface of the earth. It's hidden from the invaders, like from the explorers, but not from the Atlanteans. The Atlanteans are aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just don't want to show it to them for obvious reasons because it destroyed their city so many years ago. Kida, I think, needs to get introduced a little bit earlier on. Like, what I had written down is maybe she was controlling the Leviathan. So, like, you get a sense of, like, maybe, like, there's that shot of, like, when Milo falls into the Ulysses, like, that bubble part, and he's looking into the Leviathan's, like, quote-unquote eye, and he says, it's a machine. Like, maybe you can see an outline of Kida, like, there. Just, like, a big image of her. In this one... It's a robot, or like it's not a robot. It had never occurred to me that it might be an automaton until we started talking about this more. Like, it was 100% in my head,
like
driven by people, and it had never occurred to me to question that. And now I don't know what to think. Anyhow, so
you know, maybe just like the crystal, it's both, and then additional.
It's
thing.
Whatever you, the viewer, need it to be.
Exactly.
The Ulysses is going to last a lot longer in this version.
Thank you.
I want almost nothing to happen, like. In the Earth's, like, underneath the Earth's surface. I think maybe it can have a big drill on it or something. Like, maybe it needs to bore through the surface, but, like, they're still inside the submarine itself. So, like, I want there to be so much more in that setting, because you get none of it. The character journey, I think, for Milo is going to be that Milo learns more. It doesn't matter what people think of him or his family so much.
Yeah.
Like, he should be tempted when he gets there with the idea that everyone else is saying, like, oh... Holy shit, this crystal is so huge. Like, this is an important thing. Like, look at it. Like, look at it move. Look how alive it is. Like, we should fucking take this to the Earth. They say it's very important to them down here. We need this.
Right.
Like, we fucking need this. World War I is approaching. We could use this crystal. Like, this could be something that our scientists should be looking at. And Milo has to make the choice between being like, okay, like, it would vindicate everything my grandfather did. It would vindicate me. Or, like, I have to realize that it doesn't matter and realize that it's important to these people to keep it down here. Kida learns that stagnation is bad. Like, she's sort of convinced in the beginning that, like, her culture has to stay the same because it's the only option available to them. And so she has to go against tradition to keep her city alive. at the end of the movie, she absorbs the crystal into herself, not vice versa.
Hey.
Like, she, through her necklace, like, she takes it into her person. Like, she can still look like a weird crystal person, but, like, she uses that as part of the fighting sequence. Whenever the climax is going to be in the city itself, as opposed to, like, in that antechamber off the city with the volcano, she gets kidnapped. Like, at the end, like, she does get captured by Rourke briefly, who has, like, that case designed to, like, just kind of hold her. Milo breaks her out, and she just sort of, like, obliterates Rourke using the powers of the crystal. She decides in the end of the movie, and I stole this because I looked up part of the direct-to-video sequel, which I'm embarrassed to say
oh
that is
goodness.
Kind of a good idea. She decides to use the crystal to bring Atlantis to the surface because she realizes that they have much to teach the world. Like, at the end of the day, they can't keep this thing hidden, and it's a bad idea to, like, not share what they know with other people. The problem, like I said, a big problem with this movie is it's a white guy going up and showing people, like, what they're doing wrong
mm-hmm.
in their culture. So I want her to come up and be like, you guys are doing some wrong shit.
Oh.
We know things that can help you. And, like, we know, we've heard that there's this great war that's supposedly brewing.
Oh.
We want to help you avoid this. Look what happened when we used this for war. Like, our entire civilization was destroyed. We were trapped underwater. Like, we were stagnant. We were terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can show you what to do with yourselves. And as two minor things, Cookie is cut. I love Jim Varney, but, like, this movie needed one less guy, and, like, if you're gonna cut someone, the cook doesn't have a whole lot of reason to be a character in this movie, so...
Except he sure makes some gross-looking food, guys.
He sure makes some brown orbs.
He didn't know what lettuce was.
The other thing I would kind of like is that there should be an Atlantean who's, like, I can't remember his name, but who's that guy in John Carter? Who's the fun one? Who's, like...
He was James Purefoy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm totally blank.
I can't remember his
name
either,
yeah.
But, like, he's a guard, but he's sort of like a Han Solo kind of, like,
yeah.
fun guard. Like, it needs one of those. Like, maybe he's, like, Kida's bodyguard or something like that, but, like, you need, like, another Atlantean, because
mm-hmm.
you had, like, two in this movie. And so I think it would be
and
kind
one
of
them dies.
Yeah, right. So it would be kind of fun to have just another one who's maybe a little more, like, with a better sense of humor and sense of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, I think we've covered everything that we've set out to cover for this, for the
yeah.
most part, aside from Kida in the Box.
Oh, my God. I was so mad about that. I mean, honestly, she's like a glowing crystal person exhibiting all this power, and then
right.
the next shot is she's laying still while she has a box.
Yes, they say, like, the crystal will take her, and she has all the power of the crystal, and she wanders into a box.
It's so stupid.
That's it.
Big question, though.
Yeah.
Would you guys recommend this movie?
Yeah, I would. Like as I established, story-wise, it's a complete mess, but it looks neat. Voice casting is so well done. The music is good. There's a lot to recommend of this movie once you get past the fact that you're not going to understand the story and you shouldn't try.
When host Brendan told me that Mike Mignola had done a lot of the design for this, I realized there were certain parts that were like, oh, this is very Mignola. Like, the scene of venture capitalists in a hot air balloon shooting at Atlanteans in flying laser fish cars, and, like, there's, like, a hammerhead thing.
Yeah.
It was very all just sort of, like, a slightly wacky, a lot going on, but
yeah.
very kind of cool to look at.
It's got some of his, like, steampunky.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
It looks a lot like his stuff, which I think is, like, one of the, like, the highest praise I can have for
yeah.
this movie, is that it does look, it clearly took a lot of Mike Mignola's influence, which, good for you.
I would recommend seeing it, but go in with some pretty low expectations.
Yeah.
I really love, like, flawed sci-fi movies, but I'm gonna have to give this one a pass.
Ooh,
I
that's
just,
fair.
As pretty as it is, and as much as I like some individual elements that it presents, I just think that it's boring and kind of milquetoast. It feels very by the numbers, and it doesn't have a sense of wonder to it. Like I said, when I was kind of presenting my fixes, I feel like everything feels rote and practiced rather than like a fresh discovery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not something I revisit all that often.
It did weird me out to hear and then read that this is apparently a cult favorite.
I mean, everything says that. Like, any
article... I guess
it's an
overused term.
Yeah, it means, like, any movie that did not do well financially, that, like, 10 people on the internet are like, ooh, I love this movie. Like,
my DVD.
Yeah, you can say, like, on Wikipedia, it's a cult favorite now. Like, that's a bullshit thing
okay.
to say. I don't believe that's necessarily true. I believe that there are certainly fans who probably like this movie, or much as there are for any movies, a cult movie that does not make.
Good point.
Anyhow.
You heard it here first, guys. It's a new Drishler law.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's a cult movie. As always, you can go to our website, www.dratpack.com. You can go to facebook.com/whywatchpodcast. And that's about it. Twitter, what's that? I don't know.
That's not a thing.
Our Twitter's gone the way of our Tumblr.
Yeah.
We won't use any social media that starts with a T.
Nope. Check out our Vines, though. They're pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
That's about all I got, I think. We've covered everything, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you for being here, Brendan.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
I'm
you
very glad
me.
We got to have you back again. I hope you'll come back at some point in the future.
Please.
I would love to.
Yeah. Okay.
You guys ready to buy it out in Atlantean?
Yeah.
Go!
Go!